Morning.
Case number 11-7103 et al. Continental Transfer Technique Limited versus Federal Government of Nigeria et al. Appellants. Mr. Okoli for the appellants, Mr. Doyle for the appellee.
May it please the court, Casey Okoli for the appellant. Good morning. Let me begin by dealing with the recognition of the under the district.
Let me ask you to begin somewhere that maybe is a little bit more fundamental. You did not appeal the district court's enforcement of the award under the New York Convention, correct?
We did not.
You did not. You did appeal the district court's enforcement of the award under D.C. law.
That is correct.
Now, if we were to agree with you that the district court erred in its enforcement of the award under the D.C. law, you would still have the enforcement of the award under the New York Convention.
Yeah,
why then are we here?
Well, there are two different...
That's a classic case of mootness. I don't understand why we're here on any of your claims. I understand why we may be here to hear some of Continental's, but for the life of me, I can't. So help me. What am I missing?
Well, the thing is this. Under D.C. law, there was conversion. Conversion for that's in enforcing the D.C. law. The judge authorized...
So what? If you win under D.C. law, you still have to pay, Nigeria still has to pay the award because it's been entered against you and the district court sustained that. You still have to pay that.
I agree, but there's a difference. The difference here is, first of all, under the award, some of the things awarded under the D.C. law were not included in the arbitral award. For instance, pre-judgment and post-judgment interest, that was not included. And the mere fact, in fact, the D.C. law order does two things. Because it first converted and then added pre-judgment interest that was never awarded at the arbitral award, I think that is double compensation. First, to convert at the breach day. And then, because the argument being that the currency had depreciated. So now you're going to grant judgment based on the breach day rate, which apparently is higher than today's rate, and then slap on that pre-judgment interest that the arbitral tribunal never deemed appropriate to award. So that is the difference. There's a difference ultimately if you do the calculation. The math will be different whether you were going pursuant to D.C. law or you were just going by the New York Convention, which recognized the arbitral award.
What authority says that in confirming an award under the Federal Arbitration Act or the New York Convention, district court in this country cannot convert that arbitral award into U.S. dollars?
Your Honor, it's simply a matter of procedure. That's if they had requested that that relief from the beginning, that would be a different thing. But they knew that they wanted the conversion. They put in not only a complaint, but an amended complaint. I submit that it is the complaint that states what a party is seeking from the court.
That's an abuse of discretion standard under Rule 59E, right? This is abuse of discretion. And so the district court thought that it would correct a manifest injustice if he didn't award prejudgment interest, if he didn't have the award paid in U.S. dollars, that it would create a manifest injustice. Why isn't that clearly within the discretion he's allowed?
Yeah, with due respect, I'll say that it is an abuse of discretion in the sense that the appellees themselves insisted in their argument, in their papers, that their motion was not a rule.
There's case law that you overlooked that shows that not only is it permissible to change a 60A to a 59E, but it's actually required.
No, I am not saying that it cannot be done, but not under the circumstances, not when a party says, no, that's not what I'm asking the court.
And there's any authority for that?
Sorry?
Any authority for that, that proposition that you stated?
Your Honor, the
answer is no. There's no authority for that.
Yeah, but
you didn't cite any, and you can't come up with any now.
Yeah, Your Honor, but the authorities that I believe that Your Honor is referring to did not have the similar circumstance where a party was insisting. In those other cases, the party did not insist that what they were making was a Rule 60 motion. In this case...
And you have authority that says when a party insists that the judge can't change a 60A to a 59E, even though
your
case authority says that he must.
Your Honor, we go back to the basic proposition in an adversarial system. The courts do not make out cases for the parties. The parties are dominant writers. They are the masters of their case. Yes.
What do you point to for their insistence? Because I read them as saying we think it's 60A, but if you treat it as 59, we get the same relief. So I want to make sure I understand exactly what you point to as their insistence or their refusal to treat this as, to allow this to be treated as a Rule 59.
In their memorandum, I believe that they, well, maybe insistence is too strong a word, but that was the argument they advanced. They did not advance
an alternative. Where did they advance this argument?
That they were making a Rule 60 motion.
Right, but I thought, correct me if I'm wrong, I thought your argument was not just that they said they were making a Rule 60 motion, which happens all the time when courts convert them to Rule 59, but that they had insisted that this be a Rule 60 motion and not a Rule 59 motion, and that was the key that you were relying on to distinguish precedent. And I didn't see that insistence in the record, but perhaps you can point me to it.
Millett, I'm prepared to come back to that. I'll take any other questions and then come back to that.
Can I ask you another question then? I want to make sure I'm clear on understanding something else. You haven't raised, the district court found a waiver of sovereign immunity under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. You haven't raised sovereign immunity on appeal.
We're not raising that.
You're not asserting sovereign immunity on appeal.
No, we're not.
As to either the D.C. judgment or the confirming the award under the New York Convention.
We're not challenging the confirmation of the award under the New York Convention.
Okay. Right, but are you asserting
issue,
sovereign? I'm sorry.
Our principal issue is with the award, the enforcement under District Columbia law, especially given the fact that there's record here to show that.
You're not asserting sovereign immunity on the D.C. law claim.
No. On the
why aren't you? Your strongest argument, you're not using it.
No. I said we're not asserting sovereign immunity on the arbitration, on the arbitral award.
But you haven't asserted it in your brief at all. You didn't assert it even with respect to the D.C. Enforcement of Judgment Act either. So I just want to make clear that you're not asserting sovereign immunity under either. The district court ruled on two grounds, the confirm the award under the New York Convention and the thing that you most object to, enforce the judgment under D.C. law. And I didn't see in your papers that you were asserting sovereign immunity as to either of those grounds. You have different objections to the D.C. judgment.
You're correct on that one. You're correct on that one. But the record does show that this particular judgment or order that the D.C. court stated could be enforced, they obtained by their own admission in the record, they obtained without notice to us because so that the finding by the judge that the statement by the judge in his opinion that we defaulted because we did not go before the court is not correct because we were not put on notice. They applied for this, and I can show where it is in the record. They applied for that particular relief without notice to us and just on the papers. They didn't even ask for oral arguments, so at least we could know and come and argue. So we do not have a full opportunity.
But did you receive notice? Did you receive notice
after
that they had
the fact?
Filed?
No, not
well,
before.
Well, how long after the fact? Because I think you had more than 2 months to make a filing in the UK.
I couldn't tell you that. I don't remember because it was something done in the UK court. But that was long after. My analogy to this is this, Your Honor. It's like suggesting that in where there's an automatic bankruptcy stay, you could take actions that go against the stay, and then you want to keep whatever benefit you got from that because after the fact, somehow the bankruptcy was dismissed. I don't think that they could rely or take the benefit of this judgment, which, first of all, they didn't give us notice. They clearly said they did not want us to know about their application. They stated it in their application without notice. And on the papers, no oral argument. So we had no opportunity before that order, assuming that it's a judgment.
Didn't the U.K. court give you notice? They filed, and then the U.K. court issued an order, what they called an interim order, under enforcing the award, but giving you 2 months and some days to come and file a response. Is that not correct?
Yeah, but that was a different order. That was not the order which was recognized here. The order which was recognized was that of June 24th. It's a different order. We did not get notice of the order that the court recognized. And they haven't argued that we did. You look at their papers, you will not see anywhere where they disputed that assertion, because we refer to the record where they made that application, and they are not saying that we got notice of that particular order which resulted in the award or the judgment which the district court said should be recognized. They're not arguing that they haven't. You won't see anywhere in your paper where they said that they gave us notice of that. And I submit that such conduct, I think, should offend this court's sense of justice. It's not, you can't go behind a person and get a judgment and then come to courts here and then want the judgment to be recognized and enforced. It may well be that if they had given notice, the appellant's attorneys in England may not have had an adequate answer to it. I don't know that because I'm not practicing that. It may well be, but that would be mere speculation.
You don't dispute that you had notice of before the court entered its March 2010 amended judgment, denying your motion to vacate and reaffirming its order enforcing the arbitral award, right? That you don't dispute that it was your motion to vacate that they acted on, and when they reaffirmed the award, so you had full notice at that point.
Of notice of which order?
Of the March 30, 2010, from the UK High Court denying your motion to vacate and reconfirming the award.
Sorry, if the clerk will help me. Where
is this? It's the one on your joint appendix. It begins on page 513. Remember, you filed a motion to vacate, and they denied it, and then they reaffirmed the award? You don't dispute any notice in that one because they were actually acting on your motion, correct?
Well, we received that. We received that. But that was, Your Honor, these are all after the fact. This was subsequent to the event we're dealing with here. So it goes back to my original argument. Can you justify can you take steps that are not in conformity with the law and then justify it by something that happens after? Can you go ahead and obtain a judgment? And because you already, I think there is a fundamental difference between obtaining something ex parte and putting a party on notice so that the matter is fully argued before an order is made. I believe that there's a distinction.
What would you have argued in the first round where you say you lack notice that you didn't have an opportunity to argue in your motion to vacate?
This was done by the English lawyers. I wasn't there. I didn't argue that.
I'm just asking you to identify the prejudice that you allege from this lack of notice. How did it prejudice you from making any argument that your client wanted to make to the UK court? Because they did show up, they did file a motion, they made arguments. So what more would they have argued?
The argument would have been that at that point in time, that Continental was under restraint by a valid court restraint.
Well, you made that, but your client made that argument, or your client made that argument in its motion to vacate to the UK court. So that argument's already been made and considered by the UK court fully. They didn't They didn't decline to consider it. They fully considered it and addressed it. So that's not any prejudice. That was argued and considered. That's what the 2010 ruling was all about. Is there any other prejudice?
I with due respect to the court, I still think that it is something that, to the extent that we're here in this court, that it is something that this court can look at to make its own determination on whether, in fact, there was prejudice or not, and not just rely on whatever may have happened in the court in foreign jurisdiction. We were not there. We don't have the full records. We don't know anything else that happened. Whatever we see here can only be a matter of my speculation.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I don't recall you asking for any time for rebuttal, but we'll give you back.
Oh, I asked for 3 minutes.
Oh, did you?
I'm sorry. Oh, I should have announced. I'm
okay.
Sorry.
We'll give you back some time. Mr. Doyle?
Your Honor, my name is Paul Doyle from Kelly Dry and Warren, LLP, and I would also like to reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal on my cross-appeal, as possible. Your Honor, we submit the following. First, that this court lacks jurisdiction to hear Nigeria's arguments regarding the UFMJRA. And in any event, the arguments on that issue, in our view, have no merit. Secondly, we believe that the court had, district court had full power to treat this as a Rule 59E motion and convert and use currency and award prejudgment interest. And with respect to Judge Millett's question, we did put a note in our brief on this issue that our motion would have been timely under 59A also. That's in there. So we don't believe we were insisting.
What about mootness? Why aren't you addressing mootness?
Oh, and the mootness issue, as far as we believe that there...
Can't we avoid the complexities of the sovereign immunity issue here on the D.C. law claim? It's a complex matter. It's a close call. But can't we avoid that altogether by recognizing that the district court has enforced the arbitration award under the New York Convention, and that hasn't been appealed?
That's exactly our primary.
So what do you say to your friend's argument that there's something different at stake with the enforcement of the award under D.C. law than there would be under the New York Convention?
I think the issue of currency conversion and prejudgment is still open under either argument, but I do think that that...
Which did you argue it under to the district court? Did the district court grant it as part of enforcing the judgment under D.C. law, or did the district court grant it as part of confirming an award?
It's not clear, Your Honor, as far as I can tell.
Is it ordinary in confirming arbitration awards for courts to then change the bottom line, change it from one currency into another when that has economic consequence, or to grant interest that wasn't asked for from the arbitral panel?
Well, two things. One is, to answer your first question as to the convention, I believe Judge Friedman, the district court, basically did say, referred to arbitration awards when he awarded prejudgment interest. I think that's in his opinion, and so I guess the argument would be that he was acting under the New York Convention in that regard, I believe.
I thought the ordinary role of just confirming an arbitral award was the judges. It's a very hands-off, very deferential review, and we take the award as we find it. We don't alter the award.
I don't think he did alter the award. In effect,
did you ask for prejudgment interest from the arbitral panel?
No, but if you think of it, the reason for that is that they said this was to be paid in 14 days. Mm-hmm. In other words, an arbitral panel, at least in theory, is entitled to assume that the debtor or the defendant is going to pay within 14 days. So as a matter of course, you don't assume when you're an arbitrator that, okay, they may wait 6 years to do it and say, what would be the consequences of that? Normally, arbitration panels, in my experience, do not sort of say what hypothetical prejudgment interest if you don't pay.
But you could have asked for it from them. And surely there's risks of non-payment, just as we assume people will comply with court orders, but we issue interest awards just to make sure that they have every incentive to do so, or that the the prevailing party is made whole.
We clearly did ask for it in our complaint, and to enforce it. In other words, we clearly asked for prejudgment interest. Now, as to whether we could have asked for it in the arbitration on the hypothetical basis that they wouldn't pay, in theory, yes. But
I'm just trying to figure out, the role of courts when it comes to arbitral judgments is a very, very limited. And we normally don't alter the content of an arbitral award. I don't see anything in the New York Convention or for domestic arbitrations under the FAA that allows courts in confirming awards to add such things as prejudgment interests, or to change make a material change in the value of the award by changing the currency in which it's issued.
Well, first of all, I do think, as I recall, the district court did cite a case specifically under the New York Convention where, in his opinion, essentially where they were awarding prejudgment interest between the date of the award. I think there's second.
Right, but that doesn't mean that they grappled with this question of whether it was a decision from this court grappling with this arbitration question.
I don't think that's what the district court was. I think the district court actually rejected the notion that it was bound in any way by what the arbitrators did or that it could take the 18%. I think it essentially said, prejudgment interest is discretionary with me. Okay.
I know what the district court said. Yeah. And my question is that, again, normally district court judges and courts of appeals, when looking at arbitral awards, don't say, I don't care what you ask for the arbitral panel for. I have discretion to supplement the award. So I'm trying to understand our authority, because that seems to me the one potential consequence of distinguishing between the D.C. Judgment Act, Enforcement of Judgments Act, and the New York Convention Enforcement in this case.
It seems to me, and I can only point, I think Judge Friedman did cite a case under the New York Convention, but in his opinion. But secondly, it seems to me if you've got a six-year delay, okay, perhaps one way of thinking of this, I'm not exactly answering your question as to authority, but let me try it a different way. Nigeria said in the arbitration that the deposit rate was 12%. That was what they asked for as part of their, if they won in the arbitration. If you think about that for a second, they had the 250, if they hadn't paid the 250, which they didn't, award, and they put that $250 million on deposit in Nigeria for 6 years, which with compound interest, they would double their money. In effect, in effect, what's happening is that they would have had $500 million, they would have doubled their money. Now, that is an enormous disincentive, okay, to paying an award. That is essentially, if you're a sovereign and you basically see, well, I can delay for 6 years and double my money by putting it in a bank at our interest rate, there's no incentive at all to paying an award. And again, I know I'm not directly answering your authority question, but this is more of, to some extent, a policy question. So in that context, if you don't award interest in that situation, A, you're rewarding the person for stalling. Secondly, in our view, and this goes to our cross appeal, you're not making us whole in any way, shape, or form. And this goes for the 18% versus the
50%. Is it common for an arbitration award to discuss or address the possibility of post-award interest for failure to pay?
In my experience, my experience with arbitration is not extensive, Your Honor, but mm-hmm. In my experience of the awards I've seen, it doesn't normally come up. But I don't really want to. I don't want to really pontificate on this score because
right, because you assume it's going to be paid. Right?
Exactly. That's my point.
So pre-award interest is addressed.
Yeah, it's a hypothetical.
But post-award interest, yeah. If there's a failure to pay, perhaps could be addressed, but it would be. I'm not sure that's typical.
That's what I'd be talking about something, but it strikes me if you're an arbitrator and you say you pay in 14 days, you don't also say, and if you don't pay in 14 days, we'll award, prejudgment interest for the next whatever. I mean, that just doesn't, as an arbitrator, that doesn't make sense to me that you do that.
Can I ask you a separate question before you go to your cross-appeal?
Sure.
Why didn't you move to enforce the 2010 UK judgment? Why didn't you amend your complaint again, given that that is now the final UK judgment reconfirming the award. I'm not even sure you've enforced the right judgment at this point.
Well, I think we were actually talking about this the other night. It was essentially, I think it was more belt and suspenders. In effect, we had the New York Convention judgment, we thought, and essentially then all along came the UK judgment, and we thought that it would make sense to have two pillars to rest on, in effect.
Not even the final judgment now. Now you've got another judgment, and it's one that deals with their motion to vacate, and in which they didn't just deny the motion to vacate, it's now the approved judgment. And so I'm just wondering, it's a procedural matter, whether there really is the 2009 judgment that you had the district court enforce here hasn't been superseded by the 2010 judgment, which you didn't get enforced.
Well, the 2010, I think the district court entered judgment, I believe, in 2011. The 2010, the district court denied the motion to dismiss, which it converted to a summary judgment motion. That was just a denial. I think the judgment was entered in 2011, and then it was amended, through.
That was enforcing the 2009 UK judgment, not the 2010 UK judgment, which had obviously intervened since then.
But actually, I think technically speaking, it wasn't enforcing a judgment. I think it was enforcing the award under the New York Convention, I believe. In other words,
I'm talking to your enforcement of the judgment under D.C. law, not as to the confirmation of the award under the New York Convention. But the judgment you enforced under D.C. law was a 2009 UK judgment.
That's certainly correct there, Sean.
And the question is,
why did we do that?
It's just been superseded. I think it was superseded by the 2010 judgment. So I'm just, and you obviously had time to.
Oh, the 2010 judgment by the district, by the UK court.
Yes, exactly.
Well, no, I think if you look at the appendix, the March 30th, 2010 decision, mm-hmm. which you referred to, Your Honor, it essentially says
it's on 513.
I'm sorry.
Of the appendix.
Yeah. Justice Hamlin is saying here, is that the original. December 10th judgment essentially was self-enforcing. And if you look at paragraph 11 on page 517 of the appendix, what I believe he's saying is that it says, maybe the sixth line, no challenge was made within the prescribed period, which meant that in accordance with the terms of the December order, there was a judgment which was fully enforceable from June 5th, 2009. However, because of the conditional nature, we needed something to show to the Nigerian court. The way I read what he's saying is that once the time lapsed, that earlier so-called interim judgment became fully enforceable, and there was no need for something later on in March of 2010. I think perhaps that's a way of answering your question, Your Honor, at least the way I read this. That's what the British judge is saying. To go back briefly to my cross appeal, I've talked about the disincentive by the 12%. The 18% was the lending rate in Nigeria, okay? And it seems to me, even though the standard is abuse of discretion, if a Nigerian company such as Continental has to borrow at 18%, okay, and that was what the arbitration panel decided, the notion of awarding a 3.375 in interest just can't make sense because it's a swing of about $131 million in effect, because it's essentially saying that somehow this Nigerian company based in Lagos should have come to the U.S. and borrowed at what are historically low rates right now. But in reality, logically, you should be using the Nigerian prime rate, which I gather is 18% or even higher now. And there's not much case law on this, but if you think of it as a matter of policy, if you really do want to make the plaintiff whole in this situation.
We say there's not much case. There's a lot of practice that you use. If you're going to use it in U.S. dollars and use it at the U.S. prime rate. Certainly, and we're talking about an abuse of discretion standard.
I understand that. I certainly agree with you that there's a lot of case law out there.
That's
but
the
I don't. I don't believe there's case law. Again, and we look for. I don't believe there's case law in the context of where you've essentially got evidence that a foreign company has to borrow in its own country at 18%. Assume for the sake of argument that's true, just for the sake of my hypothetical, that Continental had to borrow at 18%. You know, and that's something that obviously could be established on remand if it had to be. How could you possibly say that giving a 3%, 3.3% makes it whole?
Because what did you do to substantiate basis for an 18% interest rate?
What we did, Your Honor, is we asked for the 18% and we cited that's what the arbitral panel did. While they challenged our right to interest, a prejudgment interest, they never challenged that amount. In other words, they never challenged the rate of interest.
I understand, but you still had an independent. Just because the other side doesn't argue something doesn't mean you don't have a burden of proof to establish the correct rate in arguing to the district court to do something.
Well, I mean, our view, I understand what our view was that the 18% was a logic. It's actually, from what I understand, that the rates have actually gone higher. But that in the context of what was happening at the time, and this has been a problem throughout this case, is sometimes we'll argue something and then just won't respond. And so then you're in a position of saying, well, do you have to sort of make their case or not for them? And that's kind of what happened on the conversion also. And so I guess my answer to you, Your Honor, would be that we pointed out the 18%. They didn't respond in terms of the rate. I think we were entitled to sort of say that there's no dispute as to the rate. And what the district court did is the district court itself basically on its own looked to the Federal Reserve rate to decide what the prime rate is in the U.S. It could just as easily have looked at the World Bank figures as to what Nigerian borrowing rates were. And we think that that's much more logical in terms of how to think about this problem. And I realize these are very large amounts, but I mean, if you think about it, there's really no logic to using a 3% rate for a company that has to borrow at 18%. That can't possibly make it whole.
We'll give you some time for rebuttal on your cross appeal. Mr. Coley, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Yes, sir. Your Honor, let me start with the 18% interest rate. First of all, they did not establish any 18% interest rate anywhere. And I argue that what they did was they asked the court to take judicial notice of some World Bank data. And I said that under the federal rules, I submit that that is not something that the federal court can take judicial notice of. Besides, they have a responsibility. They cannot cherry pick. What is happening here is they are cherry picking. They want to enforce an arbitral award which necessarily involves some interest at a rate recognized by U.S. courts, which is the prime rate, actually recognized by this court, which is the prime rate. But at the same time, they are throwing back to something that happened in Nigeria, but they didn't want to go enforce the judgment. They could have, if they wanted 18%, they should stay in Nigeria and apply Nigerian law on whatever percentage is there. If they are coming to this court then and they are asking for enforcement of an arbitral award, then they have to take the whole package, including whatever interest rate the courts here deem appropriate. It's too late in the day for them to come and say, and there is nothing to indicate actually that whatever money they used in Nigeria, they borrowed from a local bank. So that's speculation. People do borrow money from banks in Europe, in the U.S., for using Nigeria. So there is nothing in this record other than the speculation of counsel that their company borrowed money from a Nigerian court, would be used in Nigeria, with them entitles them to 18%.
Your time has expired, Mr. Coley. Thank you very much. Mr. Doyle, we'll give you 2 minutes
for rebuttal. Very briefly, Judge Millett, I wanted to page 14 of our, I guess it's our reply, but it's on paragraph, it's on 892 of the appendix. And what it says,
892,
yes. And it says, the circuits have recognized the availability of prejudgment interest in actions to confirm arbitral awards under the New York circuits that have recognized under New York have reasoned that in light of the, quote, widely accepted remedial purpose of prejudgment interest, which is to compensate the injured party for the loss of use of money, a presumption exists in favor of such interest. And I'm trying to respond to your question as to,
The American Arbitration Association's rules for international arbitration specifically authorize tribunals to award pre- and post-award mm-hmm. interest. So it seems to me that's, I don't know whether in these cases they ask for it from tribunals or something. It just seems to me we're getting, you're taking something that can be controversial and debated between parties and presumably could be a part of their arbitration contract, and shifting it to district courts and really materially changing the nature, not just confirming an award, and you're not enforcing the judgment if we're only looking at the New York Convention mm-hmm. claim in this case. Maybe if you were enforcing the judgment, that would be different, but if you're just confirming an award to then add all this amount when it wasn't asked for from the panel, and it does seem to happen in at least in international arbitrations, I'm worried about the right judicial role here.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but what I guess I'm saying is that I think there is support for this. Secondly, three things. One is I think there is support for this the contention. Secondly, as I said before, I don't think that a normal arbitration panel, notwithstanding the AAA rule, is going to sort of hypothetically say what judgment is going to be. If you know,
you're not going to hypothetically say it. You're going to ask for it.
What?
The person seeking the arbitral award is going to ask for it, courts aren't going to hypothetically say it. People ask for it.
No, I know. I mean, it's sort of, but it doesn't. I understand what you're saying. It undercuts it. But third, and again, it's terrible policy not to award prejudgment interest. In other words, because in a situation like this, I mean, it's $250 million you could make by not paying the award.
And on the percent issue, the district court said the court therefore will follow the customary practice in arbitration confirmation proceedings under the New York Convention by setting the prejudgment interest rate with reference to the general standards governing prejudgment mm-hmm. interest under U.S. law. Is that not the customary practice?
I don't. Let me say this. I think you're probably right, but it seems to me that I don't know whether this type of case has come up, but if Judge Friedman said he was applying the prime rate, what he should have applied is the prime rate in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. In other words, I don't know whether the circumstance you're asking about, Judge Kavanaugh, has actually come up, that mm-hmm. where you've got one prime rate that's much higher than what our historically low rates are.
Have you submitted to him the prime rate in Nigeria? Did you submit that evidence to him?
No, but it's essentially it's readily available from a website, just like Judge Friedman got the Federal Reserve rate from the website. I mean, that's the World Bank publishes those rates.
Did you argue prime rate in Nigeria to him?
No, we argued the 18%.
Okay. Case is submitted.